Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to residents of the San Joaquin Valley. Here is your host, Juanita Stevenson.
Hello, and welcome to Valley Edition. We have a full program for you today, starting with foster care in the Valley. KVPR correspondent Tracy Sharman has a report on the Renaissance Scholars Program at Fresno State and how it's giving foster children the support they need to get a college education. We will also discuss how Fresno County is working to improve the outcomes of foster children currently in foster care. Also on our program, a report on heat illness and what's being done to protect those who work in Valley agriculture. A report by KVPR correspondent Shelley Bronco. Plus, the growing comedy scene in Fresno County. Mike Oswego with the Fresno Bee will be in to discuss that. But we begin with foster care. There are 58,000 children in foster care in California, and for many of them, leaving foster care and going out on their own can be tough. But many of the state's colleges have programs that help these students make it through college and bettering their chances to have a productive life. KVPR correspondent Tracy Sharman looks at the Renaissance program at Fresno State.
On a cooler than usual early summer evening in Fresno, this mother and daughter take turns swinging at the park. At this moment, it's easy to see the child doesn't have a care in the world. But that's not the case for nearly 500,000 kids in the United States living in foster care.
I was initially placed in foster care when I was 4, 5 years old, and I bounced around to about, I know it was over 5 homes within a year. And then eventually I was placed with a friend of my grandmother's. So I age out of care in her home.
That's Kenyon Whitman, and he remembers what it felt like to turn 18 while being a foster youth.
And it was a pretty scary moment. It was a scary journey.
Almost half of the children placed in foster care are reunited with their parents within a year. But for over 4,000 teens in California, that day never comes. Whitman recalls his foster family helping him through the process of applying for college.
I remember actually filling out the applications all in one night and then just her talking me through the steps and income. She was like, put zero. You're a 17-year-old foster youth. You have no money. Put zero, you know, so I could get the fee waivers and things like that.
High school had always come easy for Whitman, so he didn't realize how difficult it was going to be to juggle being an athlete and a college student out on his own.
My first semester, I only passed one class. And I remember when I pulled up my grades online and I was like, whoa.
He knew he had to make school his first priority, and he raised his GPA, passing all of his classes the following semester. It was at about this time that Whitman was admitted into Fresno State's Renaissance Scholars Program.
I think they take good students and make them great. They kind of show you, you know, that grad school is possible.
Whitman is now the resident director of Fresno State Student Housing and halfway through his master's degree. The Renaissance Scholar Program provides scholarships, stipends, and support for former foster youth at Fresno State, where before the program, foster youth hadn't fared so well at the 20,000-student campus. But RSP has an 86% retention rate. Kizzy Lopez, the RSP coordinator.
So they're very resilient and resourceful to begin with, but life wears on you. And so that's where we just try to just carry them and take them to the next level and encourage them, say, don't give up. You can still do this.
Lopez, a former foster youth herself, can relate to her students. She had 75 cents in her pocket and a job at Wendy's when she left home at 18 years old. She couch surfed for a few months, going from friend's house to friend's house, until her aunt helped her secure a small place of her own. Lopez was in junior college when her mom dropped off her 8-year-old sister and didn't come back for 18 months. Together with her twin sister, Lopez adopted and helped raise her little sister.
My relationship with my siblings was a critical part of my success, both being a provider to my younger sister and the emotional connection.
California has 15,000 children waiting for a permanent home. In the last school year, Fresno County alone had over 600 foster kids in high school. And the youth that come through RSP receive lots of support, but no pity.
I tease some of my students, you know, it was hard back in my day. I didn't have independent living program and all this Chafee grant and all this stuff, you know. So I'm like, I don't want to hear it.
RSP has been instrumental in creating year-round housing on campus for students and even has an emergency fund for unexpected expenses that parents would normally pay for. Just a pair of broken glasses can have a domino effect on students struggling to stay afloat. Holiday dinners, potlucks, and other get-togethers are also part of the program.
We do social events. And it's not to kill time. It's very critical to the emotional and social development of our students. So, and it's really to build a sense of community, to let them know that they belong, to build a sense of family, and really to connect with other students who have similar life challenges. So, because it can feel very isolating when you feel like nobody else is going through the same kind of thing.
Deshauna Ricks was a Renaissance scholar. She entered foster care at the age of 8 years old and ran away from wherever she was placed with her older sister and brother.
We ran away from our placements because we didn't want to be there. It's just somewhere that where you don't want to be. You don't know the person. You don't know the people you're with. There's things that you go through and they can't relate to, or they do things to you that are worse than what your parents do, you know. So we ran from all of our placements until we got placed with our grandmother.
Ricks is now a cultural broker and is pursuing a master's degree in social work and then plans on getting her PhD.
I want to get the highest degree possible in order to go back into my community and, you know, start pulling up those people who do lack opportunities, who don't have the resources, who are outcasts, who are marginalized, who are oppressed. So that's what I want to do.
Ricks and Whitman both excelled in high school sports and had people in their lives who believed in them. Whitman.
You kind of either end up like my brother, who can't cope with what they're going through, so they express themselves in a negative manner. And then, and like the small percent are resilient and overcome, and I guess you could say just realize I have to grow up in order to cope with it. Otherwise, I'm going to fall by the wayside.
The Renaissance Scholars Program was given some large seed donations to get it up and running. The challenge now is to get the community more involved. Lopez.
The downside of these gifts that we're given from these foundations is they're not long term. It's meant temporarily. You can get your feet off the ground and find other funding sources.
The Fresno County High School graduation rate has increased 30% over the past 3 years. The Department of Child and Family Services works with many programs around the valley, like this one, to assist kids who are aging out of foster care.
They're a ward of the state, so our tax dollars go to taking care of these young people. So they are our youth. It's not somebody else's youth. They're our youth, and they're worth investing in.
For Valley Public Radio, I'm Tracy Sharman.
California has almost 57,000 children in foster care. Of those, 15,000 are waiting for permanent care. Joining me now is Kathy Huerta. She is the retired director of Fresno County's Department of Social Services. Kathy has worked in foster care since 1995. We also have Colleen McGauley, executive director of CASA of Kern County, with us today. We will also be joined later on by Margaret Jackson, a director of Cultural Broker Family Advocate Program, and Deshauna Ricks, cultural broker and former foster child. Let me begin with Kathy. Kathy, do you think the Department of Social Services and the education institutions are now doing a better job of providing foster kids with the help they need to transition to being out on their own?
Yeah, I really do. I think that we've been actively working, especially probably since 2003, and looking at ways that we can better prepare youth for being out on their own. We've put social workers into high schools. So in every Fresno Unified, Central, and Clovis high school, we have social workers that are actually there to be able to work with the youth through 9 through 12, preparing them to do all of their college applications, make sure they've got the right kind of credits, they're taking the right kind of classes. And I think in that work, we've greatly increased our own graduation rate. Not too many years ago, we had less than 25 foster youth graduating from high school. This past year, I think the figure that I heard was in the 80s. So that's a drastic improvement. but yes. not good enough.
Yeah, there have been some changes. What are some of the other programs out there that are designed to help young people who are about to age out of the system?
Well, you have a lot of you have a lot of transitional programs that allow youth, besides the Renaissance program, which is one of the greatest programs that we've been able to bring into this county, and it's had remarkable success. We have some transitional living programs in which youth are going to be allowed to continue to be in school, live with their care provider, live in college dorms if they're not part of the Renaissance program, and continue to receive benefits from us to be able to help support them. Because the biggest thing that happens to youth prior to this is when you age out at 18, there's no financial assistance. There's no kind of assistance of anything. And unless they have been able to make connections on their own that would sustain them or keep with them, they were literally by themselves. So we've got some programs going now where they're allowed to keep those connections, but allow those that are helping them to continue to get some kind of assistance for them to meet their needs.
I want to bring in Colleen McGauley. As I said, she is with CASA in Kern County. Colleen?
Good morning, Kathy, too.
Hey, good morning.
Now, do you all have a similar program in Kern County or at Cal State Bakersfield when it comes to...
No. I'm jealous for what's happening in Fresno in terms of the Scholars Program. Because as the initial piece did state, when the youth emancipates, they have very little to no financial wherewithal to pay for college. So they do have, they can get into the dorms. All of those costs can be covered. However, because we see at the emancipation stage so many of our youth ill-prepared in terms of getting that high school diploma still, I think there's lots of conversations about the system being able to help, but we're not at the level that we have seen in Fresno. In fact, we had invited Fresno to come down and help share some of their best practices several years ago, and from that, Kern started an educational stability task force for foster children and youth, and we're trying to help at the front end to try to get these educations back on track, and a key part of that is getting them stabilized in the school of origin. And there, it has been more supportive now by the entire juvenile dependency system in Kern County, paying attention to keeping that child in their school of origin because educational success is so key. We're not the shining star in that particular area that Fresno is, but I think that there's a lot happening in the state about this issue, and certainly from judicial counsel and the courts to pay attention to these educations and trying to help these transitions.
And I would assume that is important because so many foster children, number one, were dropping out of school. And not only that, because there was just so little help for them in transition, many of them would end up homeless.
Well, that is very true. I think the most recent research that I've just pulled up in the last day or two was, again, 45% to 50% of emancipated foster youth are having experienced homelessness within the first year or two of emancipation. And so I want to be the voice in this little segment about the importance of permanence with the child being a part of what that looks like, or the youth being a part of what that looks like prior to that emancipation date. And I know the state has passed some legislation, seeing that the outcomes have been so poor that now they have the opportunity to bring youth back in as adults in dependency. And but, you know, I'd also like the voice to be shouted loud and clear here to say, hey, let's get our communities involved in providing permanence on the front end, whatever that looks like. Is that people stepping up and calling their counties and becoming foster adopt parents? Is it advocates for CASA in all of these counties in the valley? You know, someone really doing family finding and really finding permanency for kids, because those kids do the best. Kids and families do best. And if not, I think the Scholars Program is fabulous, but who is willing to step up and make that permanent commitment while they're in the system and way before they reach 17 15, 16, 17.
Now, that seems to be still the major problems is when it comes to placing kids, for whatever reason, there doesn't seem to be enough homes.
I think that's true, and I think Kathy would echo that. When I was getting some of the statistics from Tulare and Fresno County yesterday in preparation for the call, I said, do you need more foster homes? And the answer was like, absolutely. And I think that as you know, you look at who are the listeners on that are hearing this show, and there might be people who would say, you know, we've raised our kids, but, you know, what are we doing with that spare bedroom? Would we be willing to shepherd and welcome in a youth that's searching for permanence? Because right now our reality is when those children, even if they do enter into a four-year university, most dorms do close at the holiday time. And I'm sure Kathy would say, who's catching those kids when they close the dorms? You know, certainly there is some sofa surfing still going on, and that's been sort of the MO, but sometimes they go back to family that we felt was not safe for them, or they end up getting into bad, high-risk activities, and then they don't go back. You know, 70% of the foster children, the statistics say, want to go to college, and I think the graduation rate is 3-5%.
Wow.
So we've really got to get a holistic, and I think bringing in our business members in our communities, telling the story and seeing who can help these youth, support them as they transition if we haven't gotten them permanence on the front end.
You know, let's open up the line to our listeners, our numbers, 559-275-8989, toll free 1-800-224-8989. And if you want to email us, it's talk@kvpr.org. And for our listeners out there, what do you think are some of the drawbacks, or what do you think are some of the hindrances as far as getting people, more people, to become foster parents? So we'd like to hear from you on that. And Kathy, I'd like to ask you, what is the best situation that you strive for in a foster home? Isn't that the problem, finding the right kind of home for these children?
Yes, it is the problem. But I think the thing that we're striving more and more for is that children do best in their own homes. They really do. And a lot of times those aren't safe situations, but there are many ways, and you're going to talk later with the cultural brokers about ways to make those homes safer for the kids. The second place children strive best with is with their own relatives, their own family members. If you want to talk about permanency, you talk about relatives. You talk about children being able to stay or being connected to family members. If it's not their mom, if it's not their dad, whether it be a relative, a grandparent, an aunt, an uncle, those are the most stable type of homes. Those are the homes that lead to the best type of permanency. That doesn't work for all kids. You're right. So then it's finding quality foster homes. People that are willing to commit to these children to help meet their needs. And there's a lot of stigma around foster care, which is why I think a lot of people stay away from it. And that's really unfortunate. Fresno's involved in a quality parenting initiative with the Youth Law Office out of San Francisco on how to do a different kind of branding for foster parents. Branding meaning make it so that the right people want to do foster parenting and aren't afraid they're going to be part of what has been a stigmatized profession.
I'd like to bring in Deshauna Ricks, who now works with the Cultural Broker Program, which we're going to talk about. But she is also a former foster child. You also heard her in the story that aired just before we began our discussion. And Deshauna, tell us a little bit about your experience in foster care.
My experience in foster care, I believe, yes, I was placed in foster care, me, my younger sister, and my older brother when I was 8. And we had a couple different placements. And like I said on the story earlier, we didn't know the people, so we didn't want to be there. We kept running. And initially, we were placed with my paternal grandmother, who raised 8 of us. So, and then during that time, there were things that happened and obstacles I experienced But through it all, that placement, like Kathy was saying, relative placement is the best placement for children. And some children don't get that. And because when they age out, they don't have that support. They don't have that help. But when you are with your relative, you know, you have more opportunity to do more things.
Why did it take you two or three foster homes before you were placed with your paternal grandmother?
I have no clue. I cannot answer that question. Sometimes family members do not step up. Sometimes workers may not contact the relatives. That may happen. Or sometimes it's a longer process for people to get fingerprinted and be passed. So I think all those factors come into play when placing children with relatives.
You are now working with a program called Cultural Brokers, and I think, and Kathy, you were a big part of this. Your department participated in a study to look at why so many African-American children were being placed in foster care and rarely reunited with their parents. What prompted that study?
Well, our statistics were absolutely dismal, and we were working, and you know, you get involved in looking at any particular cases, and it was glaring to us that the disproportionate number of African American children in our system that were not experiencing any type of permanency. We're going from home to home, school to school. It was dismal. I mean, we had one in four children being African American in our system, when the reality of it is the demographics in our community is about a 5.6%. of the children in Fresno County are African American. So when you're talking about a 5.6% being the demographic and 1 in 4, which is a 25% being in child welfare, something is drastically wrong. So yes, we asked for the Center for Social Policy out of Washington D.C. to come in and do what's called an institutional analysis. One of the most painful things we've ever been through as a county. Painful because the reality to it, what it told us, was we were talking about some very difficult subjects, such as institutional racism. Very, very difficult. Did that exist in our county? Yes, it did. Is it intentional? I'm not saying it was intentional, but the fact was, why did we have so many African-American children? We had to face the facts, and that's what that study showed us. Brought about the Cultural Broker Program. Well, the Cultural Broker Program was coming about before that, but really made us invest in that program in the manner in which we should.
And for you, Deshauna, you are now working with that program. Was that partly because of what happened with you?
Well, how I got started with the program, my teacher, Mrs. Jackson, she was telling me about this program that she was working with African Americans and trying to get children back home, trying to make their situations better. And I was interested in that because, yes, I want to see not just African-American children not being in foster care, but all children not being in foster care. But, you know, it hit home when I know that, you know, African-American children are in foster care more times than any other race. And so that's what brought my interest to the program.
And as a cultural broker, what are some of the things that you have experienced in your efforts to try to bring these families together?
Well, I have experienced, you know, children, whereas they would have ended up in foster care, we have prevented them from coming into the, you know, foster care system. We go in there, we work with the families, we support the families. We try to make the family situation a little better. We build off the family strengths, and we work alongside of the families. And the families really appreciate us being there. We make the situation a little more comfortable for the families. And so the families are doing better because we're in there and we do, you know, we stay inside the family's life whereas the social worker, you know, they come and they do their assessment and then they leave. So we stay and try to work around safety, work around bettering the lives of these families.
Okay. And Kathy, do your department, do you work with this group?
every single day. We now use them at the front end. When I say the front end, when we receive a crisis call, meaning that there's a child that's in imminent danger, the cultural brokers are now joining us on those calls. They're going out with us at the initial call to meet with the family. And we've seen huge changes in terms of the number of children we're bringing into the system because we have those cultural brokers there. It's a matter about understanding the community you walk into. It really is. And many social workers do not understand the culture and do not understand the community. And we're scary people when we come into your community in a white car because we're viewed as coming to take your children away.
And now we're joined Margaret Jackson, who's a licensed social worker, and she is also with the Cultural Broker Program. She helped founded the program here locally and has been working with it. And I'd like to ask you, when they did that initial study, what were some of the findings in that study when it came to, let's say, just the attitude when it came with the social workers working with African-American families?
Well, it was interesting because it mirrored what we were seeing. So it was concerning, but it was stuff we knew. And then we realized, okay, we're not crazy. These things were really going on. So a lot of things about not getting the right people to the right services, not knowing that much about their families. And that's why this work with the cultural brokers was so important, because it was like a click. Oh, go do this. And knowing more, really engaging the family, really finding out what their individual needs are, what their cultural needs are, really makes a difference in getting people the help they need when they need it. And I think the institutional analysis was glaring about there's a lot of services going on, but are the right people getting the right services?
But weren't there also a lot of assumptions made about the families without looking at the individual family and the individual family circumstance?
Right.
It was just assumed
right.
certain things about these families.
Right, right. A lot of – and it's like things that just happen naturally, people's individual biases, what they don't know, just looking at an individual, class, social status, race, all of those things are making assumptions about who and what people really are without really getting in there, engaging them, and really understanding what their specific and individual needs
so
are.
So for an example, a child would be taken out of the home or they would not be reunited with their parents based on what?
Well, just looking at the family, and maybe there was some concerns around substance abuse, domestic violence, and things like that, and then just assuming the gravity of what those things are and what the needs are about really addressing those particular issues. A lot of times people just – it's just what I know about domestic violence. It's my own personal biases and what I know about – and this is where culture comes in. Let's just face it. In this society, if you look at cops and all this thing – so people have all those images playing in their head. So the social worker's going out there. She looks at this situation. She sees this maybe irate parent, and there we go. We get a whole gamut. Well, this person needs 52 weeks of domestic violence, and they might not even be the batterer. So just a lot of assumptions, a lot of not really knowing the individual family and their culture and their needs.
And the other issue to add to that, because we call that, you know, we phrase that as a sort of a cookie cutter plan. You know, there was the assumption that one plan would fit all. One plan wouldn't fit in your life, my life, or any. We're all very, very different. We're individual families. But the other thing that really came to light on that, so say a family does need services. Say they might need domestic violence. They might need parenting classes. I mean, domestic violence services, parenting classes. Where do they get those classes? And if you've got a young mom that has her kids taken away and it's decided she needs two or three types of services and you're sending her all over Fresno and she has no transportation, no support system, she's going to fail those services. And so a lot that the report showed us is we need to do services for families in their own neighborhoods where they're accessible or we're setting them up for failure. So all the money and the investment in saying get this mom to these type of services so she can benefit and get her kids back, but not taking into consideration the barriers to getting her to those services, it was a total waste. And that's why we were seeing the failures in reunification, was because we were setting people up, parents up, to fail.
That's difficult. Especially when the whole, as you all were talking about,
what you really need is for these kids to be in a permanent home. You also said studies show the kids did better when they're with their parents. And I'm sure for a lot of people out there, the whole point is people do not want kids returned to a home where they are not safe. But what you're saying, in your situations, that wasn't the reason why these kids weren't being reunited with their parents.
Well, I think the real merits of safe and how you define safety, and when you're operating off a lot of assumptions and you don't know a lot about, you're going to fill in the blanks as opposed to what really is a safety issue. And so that was one of a lot of the work that I wanted in around our program in the Culture Brokers was getting a true and accurate assessment of what. And then if you see something, now, wait a minute, is this really a safety issue or is this just something that might be nice? It would be something you might want to have, but if I don't have a five course, I have all the groups, and I don't have sheets on my mattress. Is that a safety? Is it nice? Yeah, but is it a true safety issue? Spanking, whooping, all of those kinds of things. When interpretation, cultural, all of those things come to play, and then decisions are made based on assumptions, and you go down this whole line of what people need to do.
I'm going to ask you both a little bit about what exactly Cultural Brokers do and how they help to reunify families and what kind of outcomes you're having. But first, again, I want to remind our listeners that you can join in our conversation. If you have a specific question, we'd like to hear from you. Our phone numbers, again, 559-275-8989 or toll free 1-800-224-8989 or talk@kvpr.org. And before we continue, Colleen, I know you're still on the line. Now, do you all have a similar program, or are you working to develop one?
Well, we have. We've had some family finding grants from I know that the Department of Human Services is utilized, and what our CASA program, but those have sunset and the funding has gone away. So our CASA program has just been seeking active funding for what's called Family Connections CASAs, who are CASAs that are trained specifically in family finding strategies and continuing those connections and we're offering that as a resource to our court and our Department of Human Services. So these are CASAs that are well trained to go and do computer searches to try to find these family members who have been disconnected and lost. We really truly believe that that the days of where folks have said the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, so that the whole family tree is somehow suspect. You know, some of those old myths still exist. So we are actively going out and searching for other healthy members of the branches of the tree, just as our other guests today have talked about, to try to then say, hey, these are fabulous members who want to get involved, and let's encourage that and maintain that. And then we report to the court about those activities. So we are very supportive of trying to find family. And I love this discussion about, you know, what is safe and trying to get that part of the tree to step up and hold our youth and provide permanency.
Okay. Thank you, Colleen.
Thank you.
Again, let's talk a little bit about what Cultural Brokers, what does a cultural broker do? Let's say she has a family and she's working with this family. What will they do?
It's really around helping families navigate the child welfare system. If they're in the system, we're trying to help them navigate out. If they're at risk of coming in, we're trying to prevent them from getting in there. So it's a lot around communication, improving the relationship between the child welfare worker and the family, because we know if that happens, we're going to have better outcomes. We know that those families move through faster, they reunify, they'll do better things if we can improve that. So it's a lot around communication, the cultural misunderstandings, really helping to interpret what's really going on. Sometimes assessments are off because of those assumptions and all those things that people carry, and then they're sent to court or they're shared and everybody grabs them, and a broker will kind of help paint a picture of what that really means. What they're saying, is it really a cultural issue as opposed to, is this a safety
Give me an example.
So, there was an assessment that was done with the provider that was doing therapeutic visitations, and they were saying that this young mom who had an infant that she would bring to, that was in her still in her care, and she was visiting like a 3-year-old, and when she would come to her visit, she would be holding her baby and, you know, engaging with the toddler, coloring and doing, but she didn't hover over the child. She didn't follow her from, and so the visitation supervisor would say, she's not engaged. She doesn't bond with the child. She's not an active parent. And I came in as a broker just observing, and I saw a very attached, bonded. She didn't hover over. She wasn't every minute of the entire hour hovering over the child. And but she would get her started with the activity. She'd enjoy, smile, play, feed her baby, then go back to where she was sitting, so on and so forth. But that was seen as not being a good parent, not progressing in her visitation. And I saw we didn't see the same thing. And was that a safety issue? Did that affect her ability to care for her child?
Now, do you have enough cultural brokers when it comes to training people to be a cultural broker?
We can always use more. We can always use more. And the other thing, as in addition to African American, we're really targeting our African American families, but we also look at Native American, our Southeast Asian population, Cambodian, you know. So we're always branching out our Spanish speaking brokers. We also look at culture very broadly. So we have people that are specialists in domestic violence, immigration issues, LGBT, you know, different lifestyle, you know, so we try to have expertise around. So we're always looking for people that represent diverse cultures, race, ethnicity, as well as lifestyles.
So what we hear here is that a study was done, you know, policies have been put in place, and there is an effort now to really work for the betterment of children who are in foster care. But the bottom line is you still need public support, and you could always use a good foster home.
Yeah. Always.
Yeah, because when I talk about relative care being so important, there will never be enough relatives, unfortunately. We wish there would. So we need quality foster parents who are really willing to invest in children. And we have so many children that need that type of home. And whether and offer a permanency, but not always do foster parents come in and say, well, I can't. I'm not going to be able to adopt a child. I'm not going to. But there's a lot of situations where just coming in and being able to offer the kind of strong support home environment as we're trying to achieve permanency in another way, that's needed as well.
Okay. Thank you all for this discussion today. We really appreciate you coming in today.
Thank you.
And we'll be back in just a moment.
Thank you.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. We move now to our second story. The record-breaking heat wave that has scorched the eastern U.S. is a stark reminder of California's vulnerability to dangerous summer temperatures. Those who work in the heat must take extra precautions to stay safe. The state is stepping in as well, conducting sweeps of outdoor work sites to make sure employers are protecting their employees. Meanwhile, Valley Farms and farm workers are at odds with each other over different interpretation of the state's heat safety laws. Correspondent Shelley Bronco has more.
It's mid-morning under a sunny and nearly cloudless sky at Paul Betancourt's farm, about 20 miles southwest of Kerman. Two workers are getting ready to disc the wheat field with the tractor and irrigate the cotton. Betancourt has been monitoring the temperature.
Well, it was 86 when you drove up, and the forecast for Fresno is 99. It's usually a little cooler out here, but we've done kind of the heavy lifting for the day already.
One of his employees, Ruben Alanis, has been a farm worker for 15 years. He knows how to protect himself from the sun.
Ropa manga larga, sombrero, tomar bastante agua.
That's a shirt with long sleeves, a broad-rimmed hat, and plenty of water. Even with years of experience working outdoors, Alanis and the two other employees on Betancourt's farm have taken state-mandated classes on heat illness prevention. Those measures are what enforcement officials from the Division of Occupational Safety and Health, or Cal OSHA, are looking for this summer. Cal OSHA is now investigating six possible heat-related deaths that have occurred since the spring. Two were farm workers in Southern California. Officials are inspecting outdoor work sites to ensure employers are providing adequate water and shade to protect their employees from heat illness, as required by law. They've handed out nearly 150 heat violation citations this year in different industries. Farmworker advocates say the state hasn't done enough. Farmers are concerned about the subjective and potentially confusing nature of the regulations. Paul Betancourt.
For a harvesting crew, you're supposed to have shade within, a 3-minute walk. Well, what does that mean? We want to do the right thing, and we don't want to get penalized, so how do we kind of negotiate what that means?
And last year, the state added regulations specifically for agriculture, construction, and three other outdoor industries when temperatures reach 95 degrees. Employers must watch new workers for signs of heat illness and remind all employees to drink water regularly. United Farm Workers spokeswoman Maria Machuca says there's little reason for employers to complain about safety laws.
So when it comes to the heat laws, it is tedious for them, but it is saving the life of a farm worker, of a human being.
In the emergency department of Community Regional Medical Center in Fresno, Dr. Kenny Bond has treated farm workers and other outdoor laborers for heat illnesses.
You know, before I even get to treatment, the number one treatment is prevention. These are completely preventable deaths and should never happen.
Sweating and thirst are the obvious signs of heat illness, but he says nausea, vomiting, headaches, and dizziness are also symptoms of heat exhaustion. It all has to do with the loss of fluids.
It's hard to carry around gallons of water. It's not unreasonable to see people lose 2 liters an hour working out in the fields, and that's really hard amount to replace. That's a lot of fluid to drink, and that's a lot of fluid to carry around.
In 2005, California introduced the nation's first heat regulations after a spike in heat-related worker deaths. Ag groups like the Nisei Farmers League in Fresno have partnered with Cal OSHA to develop heat illness workshops, handouts, and items such as shade tents and ice chests printed with safety reminders. Manuel Cunha Jr. is president of the Nisei Farmers League. He says Cal OSHA is a good collaborator, although he believes communication needs to improve on all sides to eliminate confusion over the laws. He says farmers can't micromanage laborers, and the employees have to take responsibility for their own health. A new generation of workers raised on sodas and sports drinks needs to learn that unhealthy habits can cause problems on the job.
You can't tell a worker how to eat. You can't tell a worker how to drink. If he wants to drink a Pepsi at his mealtime or during his break, that's fine. He has a right to do that. No one has ever said that an employee needs to have his or her own responsibility. If the water's there and they chose not to drink and they had a heat attack, what are we supposed to do?
Maria Machuca of the UFW takes a different view. She says farm workers face consequences if they ask for breaks.
That argument is kind of funny. It's like saying, I will fire you if you don't produce this amount. Now you can drink water if you want, but if you get behind, you'll get fired. So I think that if they really wanted their workers to drink water and feel comfortable, they would put that water right where they can go and get it and not miles away from where they're working.
The UFW visits work sites to check on water and shade, and Machuca says farm workers have reported dirty water and poorly constructed shade tents. The union has created its own public service campaign to educate farm workers on heat illness and their rights at work. Cal OSHA officials say they understand concerns about individual and employer responsibilities. Bill Crescia is a regional manager for Cal OSHA enforcement and the state's heat enforcement coordinator. He says the department works with employers and provides training to make sure they understand the extent of their responsibilities.
Employees have to be trained. They have to be trained in the signs and symptoms of heat-related illness. The standard requires that they be reminded they need to drink water frequently throughout the day. And if an employer is doing that, they'll be in compliance.
While the heat affects many who work outside, Dr. Bond is especially concerned about farm workers.
The problem with farm workers is they're often spread out across a very large area, and so it's fairly easy to have somebody get lost, pass out, and not be found.
When summer rolls around, even the most experienced outdoor worker has to adapt to the rise in temperature. With the proper precautions, heat does not have to disrupt work or lives. I'm Shelley Bronco.
Now, Shelley joins us in the studio, and I have a couple of questions for you, Shelley. What are the penalties for a heat safety
violation.
For serious violations, say if an employer doesn't provide water or shade, that's an $18,000 to $25,000 violation. And the state can also issue an order prohibiting use or an OPU, and that's if there's imminent danger present, such as no shade on a day that's over 95 degrees. And when an OPU is issued, work has to shut down and they can't restart until those issues are fixed.
And why are some of these regulations so vague?
Well, one example is that water must be readily accessible. That's written in the law, readily accessible. But that's, you know, not defined in feet. That bothers farmers because they don't want to be dinged for something that's really subjective. But Cal OSHA officials say it would be impossible and a complete nightmare to give exact definitions in feet because farms and work sites are so different. You've got a vineyard, you've got an orchard. There are just so many variations in the sites themselves.
Okay, thanks a lot, Shelley. We are also joined by Dr. Matthew Murphy. He is with the National Center for Environmental Health at the Centers for Disease Control. Welcome, Dr. Murphy.
Thank you very much.
A couple of questions for you. Do you think people really take heat illness seriously enough, especially, let's say, this heat wave we have in the East right now?
That's a good question, and I think the idea of heat-related illness is something where people are gaining increasing awareness. With the heat waves currently crossing the nation, I think people are hearing more and more anecdotal reports about illness and deaths that can be caused by increased temperature. And one thing that we try to communicate to people is that heat-related illness is preventable. So if people are aware and take proper precautions, you can prevent illness and death due to increased temperature.
What are some of the symptoms of a heat-related illness like heat stroke or heat exhaustion?
Well, some of the first symptoms you might see include heat rash and muscle cramping, and then that can lead to heat exhaustion, which is a mild form of heat-related illness that can develop after several days of high temperatures. Some symptoms you may notice would be heavy sweating, weakness, maybe a fast, weak pulse, nausea or vomiting and fainting. And if you see those symptoms in people, you would want to move that person to a cooler location, lie them down, loosen their clothing, sip water, and just try to cool their body as much as possible. Heat stroke is the most serious heat-related illness, and that occurs when the body becomes unable to control its temperature, and the body's temperature rises rapidly. The sweating mechanism actually fails, and the body is unable to cool down. Body temperatures may rise to 106 degrees Fahrenheit within 10 or 15 minutes, so this can occur very quickly. Your warning signs to look out for would include kind of hot, dry skin, rapid pulse, headaches, dizziness, nausea, and even a lack of consciousness.
Okay, what are some precautions people should take when they're out in the heat?
It's really important that people remember to stay cool. If individuals are indoors during a heat wave, air conditioning is actually the number one protective factor against heat-related illness and death. So if a person is in a home where air conditioning is not available, they could really reduce their risk by finding public locations that have air conditioning, maybe a library, a grocery store. There's some cooling centers that are being set up in various cities across the country. Electric fans, I think a lot of people use, and they can provide comfort. But when temperatures are high, like in the high 90s, fans will not prevent heat-related illness. If they're not able to go to an alternative air-conditioned site, taking a cool shower or bath is also a way to cool off. And even if you're able to cool off for a couple hours a day somewhere that has air conditioning, that will reduce your risk for heat-related illness.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Murphy, and thank you, Kelly, for being with us today. We'll be right back with a look at Fresno's comedy scene.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
Welcome back, and we are joined by Mike Osageda. See, I did say that right, Mike. Better known as Mike Oz to a lot of folks out there. And he's joining us today to talk about Fresno's growing comedy scene. But before we have our little conversation, what I'd like to do right now
is just run a piece of interviews we did with some local comedians and get their take on what they think about what we're seeing here in Fresno County when it comes to comedy. We have Danny Minch and Eddie Trevino, also the Good Dark Girl from L.A., and Flip Schultz. Let's take a listen.
Fresno has the demographic to keep a comedy room going. Get out and do what you say you're going to do. Everybody says, hey, it's a great idea. Everybody should go out and support it, and then they never do.
6 months after my divorce, it was an open mic, and someone said, write some material, and I did. And that actually, ironically, my ex was at the first show.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Was she laughing?
Some parts, yeah. Some parts. She was a good sport about it. I'm new to the scene. I was very surprised at all the restaurants and bars that were open to stand-up comedy.
It was viewed as a man's sport. You know, the Comedy Store would kind of put the ladies upstairs and say they're second fiddle to the guys. But we, we're experiencing a whole new ball game, especially now with the internet.
I did stand-up when I was 8 for the very first time. You know, it was a talent show at summer camp, so it's just like, oh, little Flip's going to do some comedy. Oh, adorable. And you know what? I ended up winning. I beat these little buggers who were doing, like, singing and tap dancing, and they thought they had it in the bag. I went, uh-uh, little man's going to tell some jokes. It's so funny. I've seen, like, I go to so many open mics to watch young guys or whatever. You see these guys go up for the first or second time, and they're not doing well, and they go, I don't get it. You know, my friends like this, and my, you know, well, yeah, because they're your friends. Of course they're going to be supportive, but you got to go in front of a group that doesn't know you, and that's the whole key to comedy is making a room full of strangers see your perspective on whatever you're talking about.
And I do want to thank all of you for coming out and supporting comedy here in Fresno.
Okay. I'm sure you're probably familiar with every one of those folks, huh?
Well, I don't know the out-of-town people too well, although I did write a little bit about Flip last week, so I'm a little bit up to date with him, but I've never actually met him or anything.
Well, what we're seeing now, there doesn't seem to be a shortage of comedians here in Fresno.
No, there's definitely a lot of comedians and a lot of comedy events happening right now. The problem is they're so spread out and there's not a regular place. And there's a number of places happening, but it's sort of hard if you're just a casual fan to locate, you know, a show on a given night, because on one night it's here, one night it's there, one night it's here and there. And you know, it's so it can be a little confusing and I think a little overwhelming at times.
Do you think it would be better if there was, you know, we used to have a comedy club here?
Yeah, I think obviously having a comedy club would be great. I think it's one of those things, though, like, is there enough support right now to sustain it and to keep it going? You know, we sort of have this mixed-use philosophy to entertainment in town right now. And out of necessity, I think, you know, and it's not just in comedy, but it's in a lot of other areas. Like a restaurant will turn into a nightclub or will host music because it makes more sense than having a standalone venue just because of overhead and, you know, various other costs. So that's kind of where comedy's at right now, too.
Right. Is it also because sometimes, you know, the Fresno audience, even when it comes to a restaurant or a new club, they're kind of fickle.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think so. And I think that it's a little easier, I think, with restaurants, though, than it is with, like, entertainment venues. You know, people will go to a new restaurant and take a chance on it, particularly if it's, like, a big chain restaurant, a name that they know, a lot sooner than they will probably go out to see some comedians whose name they may not recognize, but, you know, someone told them it's good. Like, I think there's still a lot of hesitation there. And, you know, that's what we have to overcome, I think, in the arts a lot these days.
But we do have one club that is trying something new.
Yes.
Heroes, what are they doing?
Heroes started last week a 6-night-a-week comedy room, which the way it's scheduled out is Tuesday night is their open mic night, which is tonight. And anybody, you know, can show up and perform who's a local comedian. And that's actually been going on for a while. And then they added a Wednesday night, which is sort of a night with a regional or local headliner. And then Thursday to Sunday, they're bringing in a more of a national act for like 4 days, like a 4-day stay, I guess, as you would say. And that was Flip Schultz, who we heard in the piece earlier. He was there last week for the first run of this. Now, they said that was sort of a trial. I haven't heard how it went or if they're doing it again this week. So,
well, see, that would be part of the problem, wouldn't it? Let's say if they were to try this and they just try it and it goes for a few weeks or a few days, and it kind of makes it hard for the public to follow.
And I think that there's probably a lot of cynicism about that kind of stuff in Fresno already. Like, I posted something on my blog last week, like, can Fresno make this happen? And the responses were no, 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 you know. And so the people probably aren't going to go out right away and support it. So if you just give it 1 week, you know, maybe it's not going to hold on. But if you maybe commit, you know, 2 months to it, by the end of 2 months, maybe there's a crowd for it. But it comes down to, like, how long can you sustain that versus...
That's probably the difficulty for the owners of these clubs, is just being able to sustain something like that. So it would require somebody really, really being willing just to take a chance and see.
Yeah. And so hopefully, you know, it goes on, because I think we could definitely use what Heroes is trying to do. Or, you know, somewhere else. Places like Thai Palms, for instance, they have a pretty thriving comedy scene. They don't do it, you know, six nights a week like that, but usually they have something on Wednesdays, and then they'll have most weekends they'll have a weekend headliner who's there like Friday and Saturday. So this week, for instance, they have a Wednesday night, which is like a local show, and they have Friday and Saturday they have a headliner coming in from LA. So, you know, it's not six nights, but it's three nights, and you know, that's fair also.
If you had to, what are some of the venues now that do have comedy on a regular basis?
Okay, it's Thai Palms is probably one of the biggest ones for the last couple years. That's at Palm and Knees. Crossroads at Cedar and Shields has, they used to have a weekly Tuesday night, and now I don't think it's every week. I think it's maybe like every other week. And then the Press Box, which is on Brawley and... Probably in Bullard.
You know more than me.
Somewhere over there. They have it like once a month. Club One Casino has comedy every once in a while. Heroes, Teasers Tea House in downtown Fresno. So you can see that the venues are very, very vast and very different. So, Starline has comedy sometimes. So you just never know. And in a way, I want to look at everybody and be like, hey, if you guys just all work together and made one club, then there you go.
Right, but, and you would have plenty of entertainment. Who are some of our top local comedians here?
Some of the top local comedians in town, well, one of them who also puts a lot into the scene right now, Andre Covington, who's a radio show host in town. And also he recently did the Central California Comedy Competition. So the second year they've done that, it was like a big, you know, 50 different people competed in it, and they crowned a winner. So he's one of the big ones. We talked about Danny Minch earlier. He's definitely out there a lot, doing a lot of stuff. There is Johnny Osborne. He was one of the people who did well in the comedy competition. Chris Cruz also did well in the recent comedy competition, as well as Michelle Rowe, who you know, prides herself as being the top female comic in Fresno. So there's definitely a number of them out there.
So what I kind of like to leave this with, hey, all you guys and girls out there who are doing this, get together and let's try to make it happen and try to have a place for all of you to come and show your talent.
It's one of those things where everybody sort of has their own business dealings, you know, and they all do their own thing. But it does show that there's a want for comedy out there in Fresno, and I think it's just going to keep growing, you know, and hopefully we're going to find that venue that becomes like the venue, or, you know, the place that everybody knows about and knows to go to.
Yeah, I think it will too, because in one respect, it's really exciting to see what's happening here with entertainment in Fresno.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like getting to watch a child like learn to walk or something, you know, like you sort of see the stumbles and the successes and you
but
sort
we'll
of
get
wait for
there.
It all.
Yeah, yeah, we'll get there. Thanks a lot, Mike,
for
coming
me.
In. Love to have you again. That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.